seems to be going. Hi again. I'm back again today to talk a bit about the Heiser chapter that you read. And obviously kind of following on from last week when looking at Moore and his understanding of how we might conceptualize that relationship between human and extra human natures, and you'll remember kind of Moore's sort of attack on critique of dualist conceptions of nature and society that grasp those two as separated singular abstractions rather than as the result of a particular historical relationship between humans and the rest of nature. And Moore kind of does raise that question of how to narrate historical change, right? He makes that point that we've got lots of great theories of how human and non-human natures are intertwined and constitute a kind of dialectical unity, but he says often when it comes to telling the history of capitalism or the history of a particular state or historical period, that we tend to separate those two things back out again and start to talk about the human impact on nature rather than talking about humans and the rest of nature as kind of entwined. So he does raise that question of how we narrate history. But I guess today with Heiser we're turning, I suppose, more specifically to that question of representation in a more sort of obviously cultural or particularly literary sense. And you'll have seen Heiser's work raises that question of how we represent ecological change to ourselves, how we narrate our relationship to the world in cultural and literary texts, how we grasp or understand something like the earth as a kind of a shared environment, or how we sort of conceptualize environmental planetary catastrophe and disaster. And you'll have seen that Heiser argues that these questions, this issue of kind of a representation of the planet, of kind of planetary environmentalism, really comes to the fore in the late 1960s and then in particular in the 1970s, especially, or her focus is on the US in particular and kind of Western Europe as well. So that's, it's worth kind of emphasizing that. Well, as Heiser herself says, a lot of what she's thinking through here is specific to the US and Western European context. These ideas, these issues play out differently, in different ways, at slightly different times, elsewhere across the globe. She makes kind of reference to that, but her main focus obviously is the US and to a lesser extent Western Europe. And she makes this point that the 1970s sees this moment of changed environmental consciousness. It's the moment of the rise of environmental studies in academia, of the kind of consolidation of sort of environmental studies as a particular kind of discipline in academia in the 70s. It's also the beginnings of eco-criticism in as a sort of literary discourse that has its kind of antecedents in the 1970s. And some of the reasons for this, which Heiser, as well as other critics, have pointed to, has to do with this kind of changed environmental consciousness in the 70s, which has a lot to do with the greater public visibility of environmental environmental issues during this period, and a kind of a shift in how people conceptualize the planet. And you can see that changed environmental consciousness is both signaled by, but also is encouraged by a series of events that take place throughout the 1970s. So you have Earth Day in 1970, which was held all across the US. And it was declared by a US senator who was a prime mover behind organizing it as the day when, quoted here, a frontier ethic of expansive plunder was replaced by a recognition of the way societies are interdependent with the fragile life-sustaining systems of the air, the water, and the land, which sounds very kind of utopian given the constant kind of degradation of the environment that followed after that. But you have these kind of people organizing these days of environmental awareness. You then have a series of sort of global conferences, really, in particular the UN Stockholm Conference in 1972, which which produced a declaration calling attention to how technology was changing the earth, the necessity for resource conservation, placing limits on pollution, and the relationship between economic development and the quality of life. And it's, you know, it's a, people often talk about this conference as kind of acting as a catalyst for a global response to environmental sustainability, and it kind of it marks the start of these sort of periodic UN or global conferences on the environment that we kind of still have today, the kind of Paris conferences on climate change and so on. They go back to this Stockholm conference. And related to that, things like the Club of Rome's report from 1972 called The Limits of Growth, which is again worried about what environmental change, environmental pollution, and so on means for economic growth and development. Now, Heiser makes the point that this sort of shift in environmental consciousness is contributes to, but also is enabled by a shift in representations of the Earth, of the planet itself, and in particular a shift or a move to kind of new ways of conceiving the planet, which she puts down in part to the importance of what she calls new imaging technologies, new forms of, new ways of representing the planet as a result of kind of new representational devices that sort of change our understanding of the world itself. And so I'll come back to this in a second, but she points obviously to the kind of blue marble Earth shot, right? This photo of the Earth that's taken from from the Apollo 17 spacecraft, right? Which a lot of people kind of refer to as, it gives people a sense of the sort of the fragility of the planet, right? That it's kind of orbiting out there in space. It gives you a kind of sense of the planet as one, as isolated in space, and encourages new ways of kind of thinking about the interconnectedness of life on the planet. And with that, you get the rise of kind of new. She emphasises the importance of allegory, right? Allegory as a way of representing the planet to ourselves. So she talks about, for example, James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis, this understanding of the planet as a kind of self-regulating system that drives towards kind of balance and harmony and is being disrupted by human interference. And she has kind of interesting take on the Lovelock stuff, right? She says, on the one hand, the use of the word Gaia, as well as some of the things Lovelock says, emphasises this quite spiritualist discourse around understandings of the planet. That it's, there's a kind of emphasis on the wonderful kind of harmony of the planet, its sort of its ecological balance. On the other, a lot of the imagery that's being drawn on in order to understand that kind of balance of the planet's ecosystem derives from kind of the language of cybernetics and the new kinds of computing languages that are emerging in the 1970s. This is also the period of the development of the internet and so on, and the development of new forms of cybernetic technology, and a lot of the ideas around that of kind of interlaced networks make their way into a sort of environmentalist discourse and provide another allegory for understanding the planet itself as this kind of interlaced network of ecosystems that all kind of rely on each other in one way or another. So on the one hand, you have these new sort of representations of the interconnectedness of the Earth, something like the kind of fragility of the Earth that necessitates different kind of politics, perhaps different styles of life. And on the other, as she says, you also have these increasing narratives around global disaster, that you've got nuclear destruction, but also increasingly the idea of environmental collapse, irreversible environmental decline, pollution, so forth. So as I say, this really permeates through popular consciousness. Something like that blue marble Earth shot is key, but also throughout the 70s, you just have this proliferation of cultural productions in the US and the UK, which are imbued with that idea of thinking differently about the Earth, trying to conceptualize like a different relationship to the planet, to your surroundings. So the kind of an obvious example from the UK is The Good Life. I don't know if people have ever seen that. It used to be repeated ad infinitum on BBC Two. I'm sure it won't be long before you can binge watch it on Netflix. But it's about this couple that works in a bank. I think she's a housewife initially, and he jacks in his job, and they kind of try and become self-sufficient in Suburbiton. They kind of, you know, turn their home into an allotment. They buy a pig, which they keep in their garden. You know, hilarity ensues with the next door neighbours, with this kind of prim middle class couple, right? But the whole joke is that they're trying to live kind of self-sufficiently in the middle of Suburbiton. But it's the existence of the programme, the fact that that's taken as a topic, is kind of testament to the way these ideas around, you know, the need for new kinds of lifestyles, new ways of engaging with the earth, just becomes, saturates through popular consciousness in this time. You find, you know, new pop music, rising folk music, for example, which in this period, which also has kind of interest in environmental issues, a whole range of dystopian and disaster TV shows and films, which are figuring the idea of environmental collapse, environmental apocalypse. It really kind of permeates through popular culture. I've got another example of that, again from the mid 70s, again a UK TV programme. Which is kind of interesting because it also it does that thing of trying to figure the interconnections of the planet in an interesting way. It's a show called Survivors. I don't know if anyone knows, it was remade kind of about 10 years ago on the BBC. So the original was from 1975. It's about a man-made plague that gets out into the global population and wipes out most of the world. And so you have this kind of apocalyptic scenario, and the survivors that are left then have to return to the land and, you know, learn to become subsistence farmers again, because all the infrastructure has kind of collapsed. You know, huge swathes of the population have gone. But it's the opening sequence. Is interesting because it basically sets up the whole show, but it also maps the planet in this really interesting way, which I think kind of then resonates with what Heise is saying about these new images of the way in the 70s there is this new emphasis on the idea of the planet as a kind of interconnected system. So I'll just try and play it here. So you get the idea, which is obviously kind of, it's also bound up with the whole Cold War politics, quite clearly as well. But that sense of fear of the spread of disease in this world that is more kind of intertwined and closely connected than ever. There's a few other posters and so on from this era. Again, these are. A couple from the Earth Day in 1970, again this emphasis on think about sort of environmental pollution and devastation. It's kind of interesting, it's not always that emphasis on sort of recycling and so on isn't always progressive. The US military managed to get in on the act and encourage the recycling of waste fats for explosives, which is kind of which is interesting, I think. Now you see that Heister argues that a strong element in this discourse, particularly as it emerges in the US, of a kind of renew or a new environmental consciousness, is the emphasis on place, right, on a sense of place. It's the one half of Heiser's title. And she argues that it becomes key to this environmental movement, to many of the theories that are emerging within this environmental movement, especially in the States. This sense that you have to know a place to be environmentally aware of it, be kind of environmentally conscious of it. That it requires what she calls an ethic of proximity. In order, you know, you have to live in a place for a long time. You have to know the trees. You have to know the fields. In order to be kind of environmentally aware and conscious of it. And Heiser runs through various versions of this from Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder and Scott Russell Sanders. Again, she emphasizes this is a particularly US phenomenon which comes out of a cultural discourse around sort of nomadism and rootlessness of the US nation. And so this idea of place then is posed as a counter discourse to that, and gets taken up by various members of the environmental movement as a way of kind of emphasizing what it means to know a place and to be sort of environmentally sensitive to it. One of the problems with this is, as Heiser says, that often slips into this kind of essentialist or sort of spiritualist discourse about having some kind of essential connection to the place. And this is something that Heiser rightly critiques, and I think her critique is pretty clear, so I won't sort of rehearse it. But it's that her emphasis on the need to understand the wider forces through which places are constituted and by which they're affected, and these kind of systemic global planetary forces that she wants to emphasise. It's no good just thinking about place, we also need to think about the way places are embedded in these wider global systems, and we need to kind of think the two simultaneously, or at least to push back against those slightly essentialist discourses of place. Hence her emphasis on the idea of highlighting the need for a sense of planet. And her answer is what she calls eco-cosmopolitanism, right? She says it seems to be imperative to reorient current US environmentalist discourse toward a more nuanced understanding of how both local, cultural, and ecological systems are imbricated in global ones. This argument for an increased emphasis on a sense of planet, a cognitive understanding, and an affective attachment to the global should be understood not as a claim that environmentalism should welcome globalization in every form, or as a refusal to acknowledge that appeals to indigenous traditions, local knowledge, or national law are in some cases appropriate and effective strategies. Rather, it's intended as a call to ground any such discourses in a thorough cultural and scientific understanding of the global, that is, an environmentally oriented cosmopolitanism or world environmental citizenship. I think there's obviously lots. I mean, I think Pies is right in terms of that emphasis on the need to think issues of place and locality always in relation to these wider global and systemic forces. I think you could probably put pressure on her use of cosmopolitanism here, or at least kind of think about what's at stake in calling this approach an eco-cosmopolitan approach. Timothy Brennan, in an article called Cosmopolitanism and Internationalism, which he's running through the sort of intellectual and historical lineages of that idea of cosmopolitanism in a relatively critical way, argues that cosmopolitanism historically has combined two distinct significations. On the one hand, it designates an enthusiasm for customary differences, but as ethical or aesthetic material for a unified polychromatic culture, a new singularity born of a blending and merging of multiple local constituents. Typically in this conception, a subjective ought contains a normative is, the suggestion that the period in question is, for the first time in history, already substantially cosmopolitan. And I think you can see that element does come through in Heiser's work, right? That we're this sense that from the 70s onwards, we already live in a world that is in which places are imbricated within this larger global matrix. And Brennan kind of goes on the other hand, cosmopolitanism projects a theory of world government and corresponding citizenship. Here, the structure of underlying unity conveyed by the cultural meaning of the term is carried over to the political. The cosmopolitan ideal envisages less a federation or coalition of states, than an all-encompassing representative structure which delegates can deliberate on a global scale. And I guess Heise has sort of got, I guess, less to say on this, like as an explicitly political structure when she's talking about eco-cosmopolitanism. But I think it's worth thinking about the way in which the nation state does, or in particular, does not figure in Heise's thinking around this idea of eco-cosmopolitanism, right? It's there even in the title of the book, Sense of Place, Sense of Planet. I mean, she obviously mentions the nation state, and she talks about the way place might be, you know, incredibly local. It might be a small village. It might be the nation state. But she doesn't tend to kind of theorize the nation state as such in those kind of early discussions of that relationship between place and planet, which is perhaps perhaps problematic. I mean, one of the critiques that Brennan has of cosmopolitanism is that it often tends to kind of de-emphasize or to sort of wish away or idealize away the nation state as a kind of ground of struggle and as the ground on which certain forms of oppression are, or through which certain forms of oppression are kind of mediated or and then resisted. I mean, I guess the point is that even if whatever we might think about the nation state as a political structure, it's hard to escape the fact that, you know, the world today is organized still in terms of different nation states. So even though we know that there are these wider global forces that impact upon us, still they tend to be mediated through the political structures of the particular nation state that we live in. So, you know, the nation state still controls things, right? Things like wage structures, for example, immigration policy, you know, all those things that are constantly being argued about, you know, on a daily basis, say just around the, you know, Brexit debate, for example. You know, the nation state, for all that it's kind of under pressure from these global forces, still matters as this site in which those global forces get mediated and translated into national policies that then affect us on a daily basis. And so when it comes to sort of environmentalism also, I think you would still need to kind of think about precisely the nation state as a site of struggle in those kind of environmental discourses. It's still, you know, when people protest, you know, open cast coal mining or road building or, you know, pollution, it's often the nation state becomes the first thing that people go to. I mean, that's where those battles can be fought, right? Forcing the government to not build more roads or to bring in kind of national standards around pollution and air quality and so on and so forth, right? The nation state remains this key site of struggle for environmental resistance, I think. And so I think you can kind of ask where the nation state fits into Heise's understanding of eco-cosmopolitanism, perhaps. It's, you know, again, this is Brennan more generally on cosmopolitanism, but I guess you could think this through in terms of what it means for an environmentalist politics. We need to be very cautious in contemplating a cosmopolis that would short-circuit the existing nation-states in the name of the people. On that imaginary terrain, too many powerful interests are already entrenched. There are alternatives to a standoff between a suspect utopianism of the cosmopolitical community and a blinkered defence of the existing nation-state system. It's better to view the latter as a transitional arena, which for the moment contains the only structures through which transnational forms of solidarity might emerge in the only way they can, slowly and over many generations. But as I say, Heise kind of she's aware of these issues, I think, and she cites at one point Brennan on kind of cosmopolitanism, but it's interesting to work out exactly how she's thinking that relationship, not just between place and planet, but between place, state and planet, I suppose. Okay, so I just, in the sort of latter half of this lecture, I just want to then come back to this question of representation and the idea of a kind of adequate form of mapping of the planet and of our relationship to the planet, how we think the world, how we narrate the world to ourselves, and our relationship to it. And this, I guess, these days, I suppose, one of the most pressing issues when it comes to sort of representation of environmental change environmental catastrophe obviously revolves around the issue of climate change, right? And how we narrate that idea of climate change, how we think about our relationship to climate change and to the idea of the Anthropocene, which is what Mike Davison is talking about in the other piece you were reading this week. I just want to flag up a couple of quotations from later in Hayez's book, but I think they kind of speak very much to what she's talking about in that opening section, where she's trying to think in particular about what it means to represent climate change in particular in literary texts, right? She says, in the course of the 90s, climate change also began to make its way into the cultural imagination. Like other processes of global systemic transformation, climate change poses a challenge for narrative and lyrical forms that have conventionally focused above all on individuals, families, or nations, since it requires the articulation of connections between events at vastly different scales. So it's this problem of, you know, how do you narrate what's happening with climate change, right? How do you have a novel, for example, which is able both to represent the kind of individual experience of climate change, or sort of, I guess, everyday experience of extreme weather events, for example, or rising temperatures, alongside these vast kind of atmospheric processes that are behind that, this kind of, you know, the gradual change in the Earth's atmosphere, or something like the gradual acidification of the oceans, or the gradual toxification of the soil. How do you narrate all of those different levels and scales together? How do you kind of make that connection between individual experience and these vast ecological changes that are unfolding around us? And I guess Hayez's point is in part that, you know, one of the difficulties is novels often have a kind of subjectivizing propensity, right? They often give us a sense of history by showing how it manifests in individual experience, how it translates into lived everyday experience. But then the question is, what happens when that system is kind of irreducible to subjective experience? How do we what do we do about narrating the toxification of the soil, for example? What's an adequate literary form that can narrate that slow violence of the toxification of the soil alongside the kind of everyday temporality of, you know, getting up, going to work, so on and so forth? You can also think that in terms of temporality, in terms of something like, if you think about oil consumption, for example, which is of course one of the kind of major drivers of climate change, that idea of oil as a product that takes millennia to form, right, forming through this the gradual fossilization of marine and plant life over centuries. Oil is this kind of form of compressed time, which is taken years to produce, and then it gets burnt in an instant, right? Instantaneously, as soon as you switch the ignition on your car or flick a light switch, that oil gets kind of instantaneously used up. But what's being used up is eons of compressed time. How do we kind of understand those two temporal moments there? How can we kind of think them together? The instantaneity of consumption alongside just the unimaginable length of time it takes to produce that fossil fuel in the first place. Now you've seen one of the ways that Hayez is trying to think about how we might have a kind of sense of planet, how we might think all of these different scales together. At the end of her, there's a few other. You'll get these slides at some point. Right? Do the slides get passed around?
No, they're online.
So this is just a few other
module web page.
These are just a few other. Examples of that same problem, really, that other thinkers have taken up. Amitav Ghosh most recently, The Great Derangement, this idea that the currents of global warming are too wild to be navigated in the accustomed barks of narration. we've entered a time when the world has become the norm. If certain literary forms are unable to negotiate these torrents, then they will have failed. Their failures will have to be counted as an aspect of the broader imaginative and cultural failure that lies at the heart of the climate crisis. So again, kind of putting pressure on what would be an adequate literary form for, or an adequate representational form for thinking global warming, for being able to narrate global warming and to narrate that relationship to the individual experience in these larger planetary processes. And so Heiser's, one of the answers Heiser gives at the end of that chapter is kind of, she draws on the idea of Google Earth, right? Where she says, Google Earth is a new kind of imaging technology. You know, in the past you had the shots of the kind of blue marble shot of the planet and so on, these new kind of cybernetic ways of conceiving the linkages between systems. In our current moment, something like Google Earth might be a way of reconceptualizing our relationship to the planet in a way that might be able to do that work of thinking in terms of multiple scales. So she says, because this application is able to display satellite images from around the globe in very high resolution in close up, it's become not only a popular entertainment, but also a threat to governments and institutions who would prefer to keep certain parts of their territory shielded from public view. This latest metamorphosis of the blue planet image into a searchable and zoomable database in the shape of a virtual globe, you know, no longer relies on allegorical images of the planet. Google Earth instead instantiates what media theorist Lev Manovich has called the database aesthetic of much new media art. In his view, a new aesthetic configuration that's neither narrative nor metaphorical in its basic structure, but instead presents infinitely expandable sets of data with the possibility of establishing different sorts of sets and linkages between them. In its ability to display the whole planet as well as the minute details of particular places in such a way that the user can zoom from one to the other and focus on different types of information, Google Earth's database imagery may well be the latest and post-postmodernist avatar of modernist collage, which is now turned global, digital, dynamic and interactive. So, you know, this idea of a new kind of database aesthetic, which for her might be the way of thinking about, you know, all of those local and place-based transformations on the one hand, alongside these larger planetary transformations on the other. And it's, there's a couple of things here. I mean, she's writing this in 2008, and I think if you were writing it now, I'm not sure you would be so kind of relaxed or positive about Google Earth. I mean, certainly when someone says Google, I don't necessarily first think about it as a threat to governments and institutions. I tend more to think about tax avoidance and data harvesting and surveillance, right? I'm not sure Google Earth is something that is kind of progressive in the way that she's saying here, right? I think especially in the light of the various kind of scandals around sort of, you know, data harvesting and so on that came out, I think we might tend to think of it more as a tool of surveillance and, like I say, it might be a threat to government, but only in the sense that they avoid paying their taxes the whole time. So you can get it. I mean, clearly this idea of a database aesthetic that she's getting at here would get you beyond a kind of subjectivizing or individual viewpoint. It does then give you that sense of kind of structure and of different scales. Again, I kind of set this up, I suppose, as something to talk about in seminars, but that sense of, is it a kind of modernist aesthetic? Is the aesthetic of Google Earth a way of a kind of politicized aesthetic in the way that she's suggesting we might be able to turn it into here? Or is it more kind of, in a sense, an aestheticization of politics? If you know, one of the things that Google Earth is designed to do actually is to map and kind of act as a disciplinary device in some sense. You know, a lot of this stuff emerges out of military and other kinds of technological applications. I mean, Google Earth is then a kind of fun thing to do when you're looking at where people live or whatever. But it's kind of distracting us from these wider political questions, perhaps. I think there's a reverse way of reading what Google Earth does than the one Heiser gives us here. And that's especially the case, I think, when you think about the way in which forms of kind of planetary mapping and surveying have been so essential to capitalism as, you know, in Moore's terms, an ecological project, right? Historically, capital has relied upon ways of mapping the planet in order to seek out new cheap resources, you know, cheap nature in Moore's terms, right? Timothy Luke has talked about this in terms of planetarian accountancy and the way the mapping sciences like remote sensing, GIS and so on, have sought to reduce the Earth to little more than a vast standing reserve serving as a ready resource supply centre and or accessible waste reception site. They aspire to scan and appraise the most productive use of the resourceified flows of energy, information and matter, as well as the sinks, dumps and wastelands for all the byproducts that commercial products leave behind. So here you see how Google Earth is then sort of, you know, Google Earth is kind of an aestheticized version of this, it's a slightly kind of fun entertainment version of this, but behind it actually are these technologies for mapping the planet in the service to capital, and so in service to these incredibly environmentally degrading ways of dealing with the Earth, with resources. So I think you'd want to put pressure on Heise's sort of kind of celebration of Google Earth there, or at least her sense of it as a possibility for thinking on different scales. I'm not quite sure it seems a more complicated technology or more ambivalent figure than the one she perhaps suggests there. So just then, want to end by just having a look at a few of these images and a short film clip. So these are photographs by Edward Butinsky. I don't know if anyone's heard of Butinsky. He's a photographer who's known for taking these amazing kind of shots of this one's from his sequence of photos from a collection called Manufactured Landscapes. And he's well known for taking these amazing photos of landscapes as they've been transformed by things like mining, quarrying, the oil economy, you know, oil extraction. And they're kind of sublime in their scope and scale and the way he gives you a sense of how whole landscapes have been absolutely sort of transformed by these new forms of industry and production. And of course they're kind of interesting because they're both horrifying and beautiful at the same time. I mean, they are quite sublime in their the kind of patterns and images that he produces, but of course all of this is the effect of rampant environmental degradation, kind of exploitation of resources and people, right? And it's that kind of that ambivalence, I suppose, that it comes through also in this film that Butinsky is involved in, called The Anthropocene, which, you know, as the name suggests, is about the about climate change and the damage that's been done to the planet in our Anthropocene era. But what interests me, it has that a similar kind of ambivalence to the sort of ambivalence we might read into the kind of Google Earth figure that Heise gives us. Because on the one hand, what's being shown in this film is you know, devastating ecological change, which is having a horrific impact on both, you know, landscapes and people. On the other, there's almost something in the way that this stuff is shot, which gives it this kind of sublime, almost heroic quality. And I think that the ambivalence there is quite interesting. So I'll just play. This is the trailer for the film, which I think gives a good sense of what's going on.
The Anthropocene is the time in the geological record when humans have moved the planet outside its natural limits.
Humans go from being participants in the whole Earth to being a dominant feature.
Dominating the oceans, the landscape, agriculture, animals.
It could be a full-scale catastrophic change.
Thank you.
have not a way to get back. We live now in a different world.
It is such a fundamental change in the way that Earth is behaving that we need to communicate that as powerfully as possible to everybody.
So as I say, it's, on the one hand, you know, it's kind of these terrifying images of the ivory, of the excavations of the earth quarry and so on, which have clearly devastated the landscape. But there's that strange, the score, the kind of symphonic score there is almost kind of contributing to this sense of the breathtaking sublimity of these images of huge earth-moving devices kind of piling up. It's salt in the one thing, it's kind of stone in the other. There's something kind of strange going on there, I feel, with the kind of ambivalence on the one hand between this is clearly terrifying, and on the other it's presented in this almost breathtaking, beautiful, aestheticized way, which I'm not quite sure what to do with. I mean, clearly this is a film critical of what's happening, but the mode of presentation is kind of interesting in the way it's so breathtaking in its beauty at some level. So I guess I kind of leave that also as a question mark to take up in seminars. I've kind of left.
Maybe just a couple of points building on what Mike has said. The first one is the sense in which what Mike began with was this idea of the disjuncture between two temporal scales. So the compression of time involved, so that we flick a switch and centuries are involved in the making of oil. Are activated, but we focused earlier in the year on the same effect as it were spatially, so that we a flick on your computer activates a globally dispersed political economy or a division of labour, and we've looked a little bit at this. At the strange sense, if you go back to Lukács, the idea of time becoming space, or space becoming temporalized, etc. Something is occurring here that is worth thinking about philosophically in some way. Second feature, I think, which comes out of the Heiser, but also I think from Jason Moore, an essay that we didn't read by Jason Moore is called, if I remember, it's called Amsterdam is Standing on Norway. Very strange title for an essay, but he talks about the development of Amsterdam and of Holland as the capital of capitalism at a certain point, before the moment of England or of British capital. Dutch capital is the dominant one at a certain period. And what Moore is interested in is how, in the development of Amsterdam, a set of ripple-like effects, what he particularly is interested in. Mike showed us last week that world map, which had the effects of the slave trade, the depletion of cod resources in the North Atlantic, etc. What Moore gives us is the sense in which the Scandinavian timber forests, so pine and various kinds of alpine trees, are cut down in the development of Dutch capital. What you see is this ramifying effect. And I think this is important for us when we're thinking about the relationship between globalization and global warming. And that's the problem that Mike Davis wants us to. We have to put those two things together. And what occurs, he suggests, is that it's not sufficient to focus on a particular metropolitan formation, let's say London. Already in the 19th century, we see the development of London as a kind of ripple effect. I'm thinking of Dombey and Son, for instance, or of Dickens's work generally, where very often what one sees is this flood of humanity coming into London. So people leaving the land or leaving their families, their genealogies, and moving. London as a magnet is something that we think of very, very frequently. So we understand the idea of the metropole, but think then of the reach of the metropole, of the way in which the metropole requires. Think of the aquifers, for instance. Think of the effects 50 miles outside of London, 100 miles outside of London, 1,000 miles outside of London. This peculiar sense in which the development of the city here has hugely transformative ripple-like effects over a wider and wider scale within a country, within a continent or a subcontinent, within a world. And that, I think, is something that we do find being represented, but mostly we find represented in fiction at the level of labor. People leaving the countryside or leaving the smaller locations and moving to the larger ones. So I always like images of people. I particularly like the one of Heiser because, of course, of the parrot. I adore parrots. And here she has some red naped Amazons. I had a blue fronted yellow naped Amazon, which I called Clara Zetkin, because the other parrot I had was named Rosa Luxemburg. And Rosa and Clara were in contact with one another for a long time. There's a small narrative that I could. It's too late already. But when I was teaching about sexual isomorphism I mentioned the sexual isomorphism of parrots when I was teaching a module on sexual difference in the States. And I kept saying the sexual isomorphism. With parrots, you can't tell whether they're male or female. If you're breeding them, you have to have them surgically sexed, which is probably quite uncomfortable for the parrots, I suppose, as well, but to determine whether they're... And what I was struck by was, do parrots know that they're boys or girls, basically, is what I was interested in, if they're unable to tell each other apart. Of course, they have mating seasons. Does that mean that they are... That for the whole of the year they are parrots, except for this short three-week period in which they're male parrots or female parrots. So I did this whole lecture and so on and so forth. It was talking about Lucy Rigorian, Elaine Sixu. At the end of the lecture, this bewildered student came up to me. It was in the States, let me emphasize. And she said, Professor Lazarus, what do you mean that your parents were sexually isomorphic? I said, not parents. And then I was to a class of about 150 people, and apparently all of them had assumed I was talking, because, you know, America, parent, parrot, roughly the same thing. So I had to explain the next week that my parents were... Well, and then I began to think, were my parents sexually isomorphic? Did they know that they were sexed? And I wasn't sure. Perhaps they only had mating seasons where they suddenly realized that they were men and women, or boys and girls, and pounced on each other, and I was the result. But I wasn't quite sure. Anyway, so that's Heiser and this rather formal picture of Mike Davis. But so with Davis, we get this sense of global warming and globalization. So the one idea, globalization is not just a communicational concept. It has to be thought in terms of spatial movement also. Davis, of course, pivots his chapter on a negative and a positive. Here's the statement of the pessimism of the intellect, which he's going to complement with an optimism of the will, or optimism of the hope in some sense. And so this terrifying idea, which when you first encounter it, completely unnerves you. But then, of course, that strange sense in which you encounter it so often that perhaps you have a kind of a terror fatigue in some way. You know that we're always being told we have until next year, or we have until last week, or we have until 2025, or whatever it was. And this is an early statement of that moment. On the positive side, I wanted to focus very quickly on just on one feature of Davis, which is the sense in which the city, he says, is its own solution. It's counterintuitive, that, because we tend to think of this kind of politics as green politics. We refer to eco-criticism as green criticism in some sense, and we think automatically away from the city. And what Davis is emphasizing is how, in some ways, in order to think solutions, we have to think of cities in the first instance. For a variety of reasons, starting with the fact that a very significant percentage of populations live in cities, and cities, of course, have the resources to be able to handle these particular problems. So that formulation. There's a lovely formulation in which gave me pause, although seldom noticed by academic urban theorists, he says. University campuses are often little quasi-socialist paradises around rich public spaces for learning, research, performance, and human reproduction. And again, I found this counterintuitive. I was thinking of our little quasi-socialist paradise, and so on. But do you need perhaps to think at the level of the city again, and not of the sense of the university as outside of the city? When you think of universities, very often, here's Otago, for instance, in New Zealand. Outside of the city, very beautiful, but hard to imagine that as a quasi-socialist little paradise. This is Washington, University of Washington in Washington State. Alternatively, a contrast, that's hard to imagine, Coimbra, which is the oldest university, second oldest, the oldest is Bologna in Europe. Very difficult to imagine that being made over into a quasi-socialist state. And then I was struck also by Salamanca, the third oldest, again that huge, august, pre-capitalist piazza. How does one transform that in some sense? And I think if you contrast those images with the images of, let's say, University of Manchester, or a university built into a modern city, a very different kind of, we don't normally understand those buildings as beautiful, but we might understand them as the space in which rich resources, library holdings, capital, access to materials, etc. This is from Vienna. Davis starts speaking about what he calls a constructivist. This has got nothing to do with constructivism as we've linked it last week. He's talking about building in cities here. This means participating in the struggle for democratic control over urban space, capital flows, and so on. As you know, Amsterdam is usually cited as the world's greenest city. What the point being made is there's no contradiction between scale, size, advanced capitalism, and an ecologically conscious and socially organized form of environmentalism. This is from Hanoi. We're again late developing, but the greening of the city we would need to counterpose that, I think, with images. Just today it was announced that of the 30 most polluted cities in the world, 22 of them are in India, which is quite extraordinary. I was hearing on the radio people talking about about Delhi and just the impossibility of running, for instance, in Delhi. An athlete had run there last week. She competes for India, but had immediately started vomiting because the air is so rank. In Delhi, it's the equivalent of basically smoking 30 or 40 cigarettes a day, which is extraordinary. 22 of the 30. Meanwhile, the Chinese cities have belatedly begun to improve. So Beijing has moved out of the top 100 most polluted cities. So I just wanted to emphasize this question of the city as a way of opening up the discussion for tomorrow. Thanks.